The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield, A1 News and Talk Station.
Welcome to The Money Show. It's brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. Lynn Brown, the Minister of Public Enterprises, page 17 of a 26-page prepared statement, which tells you everything you would expect to hear. It is a combination of strong denials and stronger repudiations of evidence that has been led before at the parliamentary inquiry into Eskom in Parliament in Cape Town. I'm going to keep an eye on it. And once we get to the Q&A part, to the juicy bits, to the bits where people like Pravin Gordhan start prodding with a red hot poker, then it may get a bit more interesting. So we'll keep a very close eye on that and bring you the bits that you need to hear this evening here on The Money Show. Inflation better than expected. So that was a piece of good news which helped the banking and retail shares today. We've got a rate announcement tomorrow. I don't think there'll be a cut. Do you think there'll be a cut? 31702 31567. What do you think there'll be tomorrow? Your guess is as good as anybody else's. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual, and then the new chair of the SABC, powerful individual in studio with us tonight, our shapeshifter this evening. Your fast fact, courtesy of MTN Business this evening. Who has kept a data breach secret for a year? Your fast fact with MTN Business. To protect your business, visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA. If you think you know the answer to today's fast fact question, let me know on our SMS lines, 31702 31567, or you can tweet me at Bruce Business. Who has kept a data breach secret for a year?
The Money Show.
Your number one news and talk station.
Kevin Lings, the chief economist at Stanlib. Bear with us for a second, Kevin, because I just want to touch base with Rahima Esop, who's in Parliament. And I don't want you, Rahima, to be missing too much of what Lynn Brown is saying. It's been an extraordinary 24 hours in Parliament. Brian Molefe's testimony last night overtaken by the revolutionary change in Zimbabwe. But today we had Zola Tsotsi, the former chairman of Eskom, making explosive claims about who was behind the suspension of several of the utilities executives and making some very meaty allegations.
Yes, absolutely. He suggested that Dudu Mugyeni was the one who broached the idea during a meeting that was held at President Jacob Zuma's Durban residence. That meeting took place in March 2015, several days before four Eskom executives were suspended. Now, during that meeting, Mugyeni was present. He was present, as well as Mugyeni's son and a lawyer was also present. Later in that meeting, President Jacob Zuma walked into the room and Mugyeni explained what the discussion was about, and Tsotsi told MPs that the president fully understood what was about to happen, and in fact, the president said that he would contact Minister Lynn Brown.
And then there were also allegations that Salim Essa was dictating who and who should not be part of subcommittees of Eskom and those sorts of very high-level, powerful, influential appointments.
Yeah, the key figures in the state capture machinery, Salim Essa is one of them. He's emerged as a key figure in this inquiry. According to Zola Tsotsi, he met Salim Essa and Tony Gupta at Public Enterprises Minister Lynn Brown's home. That meeting took place shortly after the new board was appointed in December 2014. At that meeting, he says that Salim Essa wanted to meddle in the affairs of the Eskom board. In fact, what Salim wanted to do was to influence who would be appointed to certain subcommittees within the board. Now, that is the authority of the board members. The board members decide who chairs the subcommittee for tender, who chairs the subcommittee for people in governance, for example. And that list is then given to the minister who approves it, that Salim Essa wanted to influence. And now we're hearing from the public enterprises minister. She's responding to some of those allegations.
She's taking out the shaggy defense. It wasn't me. I knew nothing.
Yeah, well, she has a long night ahead of her, and I expect that MPs will keep her firmly in the hot seat for several hours. Now, she's done three things, in my opinion. She began by denying Zola Tsotsi's allegations that she is clearly associated with the Guptas. She then used the opportunity to give MPs a lengthy rundown of the framework governing the relationship between the stakeholder, the board, and the executives of state-owned companies. She says there's a perception out there that ministers, as the shareholder, are like super CEOs with an all seeing eye and special powers to detect and smite the enemy. And she says that while she sometimes would jump at the chance to get the bad guys, the reality is that the shareholders' superpowers are constrained by legislation and regulation. So you can see what kind of picture she's painting there. And then the third thing that she's done, she's done what others who have testified in this inquiry have also done. She's thrown people under the bus. And her target here has been Suzanne Daniels. She said that the committee has taken Daniels' contradictory evidence at face value without questioning it. She also said that when Daniels appeared before the Public Enterprises Portfolio Committee previously, she said that she had learned of the pension arrangements of Brian Molefe when she read about it in the Sunday newspaper, yet prior to her testimony in the inquiry, she told the committee that she actually defended the pension arrangement before the committee. So it's that. so that's what the Public Enterprises Minister pointed out today.
Yeah.
And I expect her to be in that seat for a very long time.
I mean, and as she says, she's not the super CEO, should have known anything, which implies Brian Molefe should have known a whole bunch of stuff. And last night he was also in the in deny mode, flat out.
You know, I'm looking for the right adjective to describe Brian Molefe's performance last night. He came across as cocky and cheeky. He reminded me of the president when the president answers questions in the National Assembly, denial and refusing to take responsibility. But he was adamant that he did not resign from Eskom. He is adamant that he took early retirement, but the decision by Eskom to grant him that early retirement was, in his words, quote-unquote, common error.
Don't we wish we all had a common error? Rahima Esop, thank you very much. Eyewitness News reporter. Back to listening to Lynn Brown's testimony. She must be on page 20 or 21 by now. And then the quizzing will begin, and that's where it gets interesting. Kevin Lings, the very patient chief economist at Stan Lib, with us this evening. Thank you for your patience, Kevin. Does this stuff have any impact on the economy? It's my sense of it, it's like a bout of wind, better out than in, frankly, and almost as treacherous.
Evening, Bruce. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I would argue that at least we're starting to find out a lot of this information and other bits and pieces and starting to piece together the puzzle, even if it is alarming in terms of some of the developments that have been going on. I think it's part of trying to move the country forward and ultimately find a better political solution. So in that sense, I think there would be some degree of optimism surrounding these types of revelations.
I would agree with you. Now, the Reserve Bank's Monetary Policy Committee has been meeting today. They'll decide by 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon whether or not to leave rates unchanged, to cut or to hike. The MPC surprised the market last time around by not cutting rates, and that decision's probably been vindicated when you look at the gross uncertainty that has beset our economy over the last couple of months.
Yeah, I think that's right. Last, if you remember back in September, there was an expectation that the Reserve Bank would cut by 25 basis points. I think that expectation was fairly broadly held in the market. And the reason was that prior to that, the Reserve Bank had already cut rates and was talking a fairly dovish tone in terms of inflation under control, growth fairly weak. But clearly what changed in their minds was literally the proximity to the credit rating and the uncertainty around the credit rating decision, coupled with obviously the uncertainty around the political outcome in December. And I guess just a general worry that if you cut interest rates, you make yourself more vulnerable if these decisions go against you to potential more currency weakness and then in turn more inflation. And so then you find yourself having to put up interest rates, having just cut rates. So I guess back then they decided the better option was simply to go on hold. And even though when you look at today's inflation number, I thought it was quite good, the sub-detail is quite encouraging, inflation on the whole under control. So if you looked at the inflation number, you looked at the growth number, you would say South Africa could justify a cut in interest rates. But the immediacy of the credit ratings and the political election in December suggests, again, the Reserve Bank probably remains on hold and then tries to judge where we are in terms of these parameters early next year.
Yeah, I mean, it looks like we will stay on hold. Are you worried about the expected 70 cents a litre petrol price increase next month? The potential there to unsettle this particular quite calm picture that there is in the inflation basket right now?
Bruce, I think it'll push inflation up, obviously, when it occurs. It's a substantial increase at exactly the wrong time because, obviously, people are preparing to go on holiday, filling up tanks to travel. All of that is unhelpful and obviously dips into people's income in that month. So inflation should go up as a consequence. We're looking at, I don't know, 65, 70 cents a litre. It's a meaningful increase. But it's happening in an environment where generally inflation's under control. And beyond this, I do think inflation will move lower in the early part of next year. And then we have to gauge what's happening back then with the currency and how much Eskom gets as a tariff increase in the middle of next year. So there are a number of factors further out. But I think in the short term, despite the petrol price increase, I think inflation still mostly behaved.
Now, I'm going to test. I don't know if there was some cult in the 1960s. I'm sure there was, the cult of wishful thinking. And the cult of wishful thinking on the market today seems to suggest that there is the outside chance that the ratings agencies, Fitch and Moody's, on Friday night, S&P and Moody's? S&P and Moody's will not take us into the downgrade donga.
Yeah, I think that has built as a, I wouldn't say a broad consensus. I think if you look at certainly in the numbers that were presented in the medium-term budget policy by Melusi Gigaba, I thought they were shocking. If you look at the debate around education, the pain of education, I thought that wasn't handled particularly well. So there's enough there if the rating agencies wanted to act and to downgrade us, remembering that we're on a negative watch by both Moody's and Standard & Poor's. I think they'd be able to justify it. The debate we're trying to have is, do they simply give us a little bit more time in order to assess what happens with the ANC elective conference? And do things start to improve a little bit in terms of domestic confidence next year? And can we look at a better economic outcome? In which case, you would be downgrading the country literally 3 weeks before a major political event. And so that feeds into a narrative that says, well, maybe they give us a little bit more time. Obviously, if they do that and then things don't materially improve early next year, then you would almost be certain of a downgrade. But it is a valid argument, and we know that the rating agencies, when it comes to these types of critical decisions, and this is a big decision, want to err on the side of caution, want to be careful about the decision, want to make sure it's the right decision, etc. So I think the markets have moved slightly in that direction. Maybe a little bit, as you say, out of hope than real analysis, but it's come in certainly a little bit into the currency market.
The only analysis I've got right now is hope. Kevin Lings, chief economist at Standard, but South Africa's national analysis paralysis, hope. Kevin Lings, thank you, chief economist at Standard.
The Money Show.
The markets.
Lots of you spot on with tonight's Fast Fact. Who has kept a data breach secret for a year? I'll share that with you in just a few minutes' time. Chris Stewart from Investec Asset Management. Last night, the record through 61,000. A bit of a pullback today, but largely as a result of a bit of optimism in our market, bizarrely enough. The currency strengthening just a touch. Inflation seemingly more under control. Possibly the credit ratings agencies willing to give us another pass. Bless them. I mean, all of these things coming together quite nicely today.
Yeah, Bruce, but with Naspers down almost 5% on the day, there's no ways the market can go up given the market capitalization and the contribution to the index. So I guess for those managing against the index, at least a little bit of cheer, because on a day when Naspers goes down, it's a little bit easier to outperform the index when it's about 24% of the SWIX, Bruce. But as you point out, some other positives in the market. A couple of stock-specific stories and, generally speaking, a slightly more constructive tone on the macros, with the currency a little bit stronger and the bond market a little bit stronger too.
Now, I didn't know that Naspers could go down. I mean, it's a bit of a shock to me, frankly. It broke my heart. 3.5% down. It's broken.
And what's interesting, if you look at the Naspers movement today, despite the fact it's still up 13% on the month and 94% year to date, so let's just add a bit of context. Naspers today went down by 86 billion rand in terms of market capitalization. It lost more than Tiger Brands or MediClinic's entire market cap today, Bruce.
It's a 3.5%. It's a, look, we keep saying it's insane and it keeps becoming more and more insane. I've got a question for you, Christo. Well, I don't have a question. Robin in Parkview has a question. Hello, Robin in Parkview. You have a question for Chris Stewart.
Hi, yes. I wanted to find out. I was given, when I was 16, 419 Sasol shares. And in the last, the last 6 years, I've basically been watching what these shares have been doing and taking a bit of interest in them. So I think my question is just to find out what I should be doing with these shares now. Should I hold on to them? Should I sell them? Should I diversify my investment?
Oh, big words, Robin.
Exactly.
I'm assuming you're 22 years old now, right? Because you said for the last 6 years you've been watching these shares and you got them when you were 16.
No, I'm 33.
You're 33. Oh, so you've had these shares for an awfully long time. You've had them half your life.
Yeah, exactly.
And you've seen them go from very little to over 600 rand a share down to current levels of about 430, 440 rand a share. And you wonder whether it's worth bothering.
Yeah, should I just sit with them, or should I start taking an interest and working with them? Yeah,
you should definitely take an interest. But I mean, Robin, thank you so much for your call. Robin in Parkview and Joburg this evening. She inherited 419 shares. Rough calculation, that's about 180,000 rands worth of Sasol, Chris Stewart, which is nothing to sneeze at.
No, Bruce, and I'm not a registered financial advisor, so I'm not going to provide financial advice to Robin specifically. No. That said, I wonder why she didn't look at it for the first 11 years that she had them.
She's now at an age where she's taking responsibility. Let's be fair here, Chris.
It's been fairly dull looking at Sasol for the last at least five of those 6 years, because it's been fairly range-bound. And a month ago, I would have said, well, Sasol, actually, you definitely shouldn't be selling them, because, if you look at the relationship between the Sasol share price and the Rand price of oil, it tends to be a reasonably tight fit over time. And about a month and a bit ago, the oil price was gapping up quite nicely. The Rand was weakening a little bit. Sasol hadn't moved. But then since the end of September, I think Sasol's probably up somewhere around 20%. I think it was trading at 360, 370, now closer to 440. And at 440, you are looking on a sort of price earnings multiple of about 13 times, dividend yield of 3%. That said, I would argue that there is probably upside to consensus forecast. This is to June next year. Remember, they've got a June year end. I'd say there's probably upside if the Rand oil price can hold. And we've seen signs, I guess, that the oil price has proven somewhat sustainable above 60 Rand. Famous last words there, Bruce. And if I was a betting man, I wouldn't necessarily bet on the Rand strengthening from these levels. So I wouldn't sell them all. Were they my shares, I wouldn't sell them all. However, I probably wouldn't have all of my portfolio in one particular stock purely from a diversification perspective.
And thank you for that, Chris. I'm going to try and remember, Robin, to ask that same question to Warren Ingram, because he is registered financial advisor. But it's a great question, and thank you for the thoughts on Sasol there. I just look at this as a wonderful opportunity for Robin to broaden her perspectives on the market. I really do. I was chatting to David Shapiro at a separate conversation earlier on today, just talking about some history of the markets. And he was saying just how many families who were so wealthy in the 1960s and 1970s who sold their businesses to the massive conglomerates of SAB and Anglos at the time. And today, those families have very little because they kept their assets in cash. And the only suggestion I would give is you don't put stuff into cash and leave it there in perpetuity. Tsohor San, worth a flutter?
Yeah, Tsohor San. I mean, it's a difficult environment. And in a difficult environment, they've done okay. They did pre-announce a couple of weeks back that earnings would be down, I think, between 9 and 11%. And lo and behold, earnings were down 10%. No great surprise there. You've got a gaming business, and we know that gaming's under a huge amount of pressure. It's a consumer discretionary item. It's a tough environment, and we have seen a couple of big casinos opening up in the Johannesburg region recently. That's added to competition. competition. So, you know, revenue's flattish to slightly down, and you do have some natural cost growth within those businesses. So, you know, if revenues are flat, you do quite well to limit earnings declines to the sort of 10% area. Similarly, the local hotel business occupancy rates down slightly. You're not getting any price increases through in your rooms. And as a result of that, you get a little bit of negative operating leverage coming through there as well. And you've got an international hotel portfolio, which certainly on a comparative period basis, the rand is stronger than the prior comparative period. So you've got some currency drags there. It's not a great environment, and they controlled the things they can control reasonably well, and provided a suitably bearish outlook statement for the second half. I would do the same given the businesses they're in and given the line of sight that you've got for the South African market over the next 6 months.
A quick explanation on a massive double-digit leap on Impala on the day. I didn't see any news. What did I miss?
Well, they appointed a new chief operating officer yesterday, which I think has been reasonably positively received. You know, it's all about getting the operations in the Rustenburg lease area to be more cost efficient. Add that to the fact that there's a few things going in Impala's favor. It's been a beaten down stock this year, hasn't been particularly loved. You're seeing the Rand Platinum Group Metals or PGM basket up over 14,000 rand an ounce right now, so that's going in the right direction. You know, dollar platinum price has been okay, rand dollar's been weaker. The operational update for the first quarter that they provided quite recently, that was the quarter ending September, sounded pretty good. No earnings numbers talked about, but operationally it looks as though that's getting better. And maybe the cherry on the cake is people are saying, well, Zimplats, which makes up a reasonably material part of Impala's business, maybe that's not quite such a basket case if the new regime within Zimbabwe perhaps go cap in hand to the IMF to get some dollars, and as a consequence of that, start behaving a little bit better than they have been previously, Bruce.
Chris Stewart from Investec Asset Management.
The Money Show. Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
So earlier in today's Fast Fact with MTN Business, I asked you, who's kept a data breach secret for a year? And absolutely everybody who responded got it right. It was nice and gentle and easy. It's to soften you up, you see, because it can't be brutal all the time. Otherwise, the brutality loses its brutalness on a Friday. Uber concealed the hack that affected 57 million customers and drivers. The firm has also confirmed that it paid hackers $100,000 to delete the data they stole. The hackers found 57 million names, email addresses, mobile phone numbers, and the chief security officer of the company has naturally left, but it's not clear if South African customers and drivers were affected. It doesn't seem so at this stage, but Uber kept it secret for a year. It doesn't do the brand any favors, not one little bit at all. Here's some more fast facts about MTN Business. MTN Business understands the importance of protecting what helps your business grow, like your data. That's why they are the ICT provider with end-to-end security solutions. MTN cybersecurity includes vulnerability assessments, IT network security, email security, firewalls, and mobile device security. I should give them your number, MTN Business. Give Uber your number. To protect your business, Uber, visit mtnbusiness.com/ZA. If you know your fast facts, remember to join me for the MTN Biz Quiz on Friday, where if you're the whiz of the Biz Quiz, you could win 2,000 rand in cash.
The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield.
Coming up on your next Money Show, it's all about the interest rate announcement. It's all about what might happen with the ratings agencies. Plus, of course, Pavlos Fotidis with his regular look at small business. Take all of your questions. And Warren Ingram is looking at what you should do with your investments right now with all of the uncertainty that's swirling around. People are panicking. You mustn't. Listen to Warren next time on The Money Show.
The Money Show.
One news and talk station.
The Money Show is brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. What are the implications for you if South Africa is kicked out of the World Government Bond Index? And that could happen if we get the downgrades that many expect will happen this Friday. Gina Schumann is economist with Citibank South Africa. It's Citibank's big index that everybody wants to be part of in the world. Gina, what is the implication of being booted out of it?
Well, hi, Bruce, and thanks for having me. The implications are quite dire. You do need a downgrade by both Moody's and S&P in order to trigger the booting out of the Citi WGBI. But the reason we're so focused on it is because there's about 100 billion rand, roughly. The estimates do range from about 80 billion to 140 billion. But if you go on the consensus estimate, we're looking at about 100 billion rand in rand outflows from the country.
Now, okay, why do I care whether 100 billion rand goes out or 100 billion comes in?
Well, because if it goes out, then the currency gets weaker. And, of course, if the currency gets weaker, then things in South Africa get more expensive. So to the man on the street, inflation will hit. And when inflation hits, we do know what happens after that. Well, we probably get interest rate hikes. And the double whammy of that is obviously painful for the consumer, which is painful for GDP growth in the economy. So overall, it's not a good thing if it had to happen to South Africa.
Now, might the ratings agencies, might they be able to hold off for a month until they see whether or not a new leader of the ANC will be ratings positive or negative? I mean, ratings agencies don't want to play politics or play God in any sort of way, but they also are, I think, quite cognizant of the very major step a downgrade to junk is.
Yes, they certainly might. And I must say, we have said publicly that this is a very close call. And I think it's exactly what you say. While the quantitative data out there could justify downgrades quite easily at this point, it's that qualitative discretion of these rating agencies as to whether they should do it now or might they need to wait and see. But actually, I don't think it's the outcome of the election specifically. I think if they do wait and see, it would be to wait and see how that actually impacts the February budget next year.
Uh-huh.
Because let's face it, it was the medium-term budget in October this year that really started to get us very concerned that these downgrades might come sooner rather than later.
Now, is a downgrade all bad news? And I'm really scraping the bottom of the barrel here, because there are these things called junk bonds, and they are assets which deliver a higher yield to investors. And people and investors, whether they be countries or sovereign wealth funds, whatever they might be, often like junk bonds, especially marginal junk bonds, because they tend to bring big higher yields in countries that may very well one day get themselves out of junk status. That might it not, soften the blow for South Africa in the event of a full downgrade?
Yes, certainly. And I think that that type of rationale puts the estimates of the outflow at the bottom of the range. Simply because some of those outflows are probably going to be countered by inflows coming into what we call high-yielding assets. So in other words, the higher your yields go, because almost the uglier you get as a country, the more you attract. That's particularly true at the moment because globally we've got a lot of liquidity sloshing about. But, and this is a big but, for an economist like myself, there are two things that make the rand still more vulnerable. Because we're in the Wigby right now, we get a consistent monthly inflow, regardless of what South Africa does. Whether we fire finance ministers, you know, whether we have been downgraded in the past, we've been getting these consistent inflows since 2012, and that's been quite helpful for the rand, given the last 5 years in South Africa haven't looked very pretty. But what's also true is that if you are finally going to move into being a junk-rated economy, at the end of the day, it signifies that you're not as creditworthy as you were before. So while we talk a lot about flows coming in and out of financial market instruments, at the end of the day, it's still not good for South Africa as an investment destination for bricks and mortar, because it does just mean that we're a riskier place, higher cost of capital, and that needs a bigger return on investment.
And it makes us that much more volatile. And we already are one of the most volatile places on earth, socially, politically, and economically, as well as from a market perspective. We could do with a little less volatility, in my mind.
Well, absolutely. That's why we label it the random at times, simply because it's very difficult to predict. And the volatility doesn't help things like policy making. It doesn't help exporters, doesn't help importers. So it certainly is something, stability of the currency is something we're looking for, and that's why the downgrades are ultimately not a good thing.
You call our currency the random because it's random. I love it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Gina Schoeman, economist at Citibank. Economists with senses of humor at Citibank South Africa. 24 hours ago, people were taking to the streets of Joburg. People were taking to the streets of Harare in absolute celebration at the end of the Mugabe, three and a half, nearly four decades in control. Trevor Ngube is the chairman of Alpha Media Holdings in Zimbabwe, the deputy chair of the Mail and Guardian in South Africa. And you've been so restrained. You've been so quiet, Trevor, for the last week as the armored vehicles rolled into Harare and Robert Mugabe found himself under house arrest. But finally, you're coming out and telling us what you feel. It's 24 hours after the quietest revolution in African history. How do you feel?
On top of the world, Bruce. And good evening to you and your listeners. I deliberately decided over the past week not to insert myself in the story. Rather. Help people understand what was going through my Twitter timeline. Primarily because the situation was pretty sensitive and it was fluid and it was volatile. And I didn't want to give an interview and say something that would complicate things. Trevor Ngube being Trevor Ngube has the tendency to do that.
That's why we wanted you to speak. We wanted to hear what you were really feeling. I mean, were you apprehensive that this was, did you feel that this could go wrong?
I was apprehensive, and I thought, Bruce, that my biggest fear was that it could turn violent. You have no idea how excited I was on Saturday to see Zimbabweans getting out in their huge numbers, celebrating. And something which people have not pointed out, Bruce, young people, the millennials, people that we call North Brigade, dominated the crowds. For me, that says something happened on Saturday that we might not be able to put back in the book, and that's a good thing. That's a fantastic thing. It was peaceful. I have never been proud as a Zimbabwean as I was on Saturday, and then what happened yesterday just blew me apart.
Do you know Emmerson Mnangagwa?
I have met Emmerson Mnangagwa very briefly, only once. What I do know about him is through reading, through talking to people, and indeed the terrible baggage that he has as a man who's feared, you know, his nickname is Crocodile, and I don't think you can hug a crocodile, hey? crocodiles are dangerous animals, and he's feared. He has this terrible reputation as a man who can be pretty brutal. And I think what happened in Matabeleland, where 20,000 people were murdered at the hands of Robert Mugabe's North Korean-trained army, speaks volumes about the kind of legacy that he has. The fact that for 37 years he was close to Robert Mugabe is going to take some effort for him to distance himself from the terrible history, the terrible damage that Robert Mugabe has caused on our country. But I'm generous right now, Bruce, and I want to give the man a chance. I want to think that the man was exiled for 2 weeks, and that in that 2 weeks he got an opportunity to reflect on the things that he and Robert Mugabe did which were wrong. And I'm hoping that Mnangagwa's first speech addressed to the nation is going to be huge. Something close to I have a dream, something close to the audacity of hope, something that says, I am sorry I made mistakes. Give me an opportunity to make up. I can bring us all together and let's come together and co-create a new society. I'm looking forward to that. If he does that, if he apologizes for Gukura Wundi and all the dastardly things that were done, I might be prepared to hug this crocodile.
Trevor Ngube, chairman of Alpha Media Holdings in Zimbabwe, the deputy chair of the Mail and Guardian. His first reactions to the revolution that happened just 24 and a half hours ago. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. It's good to have you with us on this Wednesday evening. Colin Cullis standing by with Business Unusual. The Money Show brought to you by Old Mutual, a licensed financial services provider. Today's the day. Get great financial advice. Do great things. You've got to feel for the members of the parliamentary committee having to listen to hours and hours of testimony and cross-questioning. But it's one of the healthiest things that's happened in our democracy in recent years is the seriousness with which the parliamentary committee into public enterprise Enterprises is taking the capture of Eskom. It's very clear that it's happened. It's not clear exactly how it's happened. The picture's beginning to emerge, as Ravi Gordhan, who's part of that committee, has often told us, we need to connect the dots. And it was Zola Tsotsi who today, one of the former chairmen of Eskom, who connected many, many dots that hadn't yet been connected, not publicly anyway. There have been lots of inferences, lots of suggestions through the Gupta mails, lots of journalistic investigations suggesting very strong connections in the way in which Zola Tsotsi painted the picture today, connections between Salim Essa, the Guptas, and Lynn Brown. Meeting in her house was the testimony from Zola Tsotsi. She's on the stand. She's in the hot seat rather than on the stand. This is not a court of law. It is parliament, and she is giving evidence. And she is answering MPs' questions. I think the heat is yet to be turned up sufficiently for us to dip into it live, but we are keeping an ear and an eye on it. Her composure has not changed very much. She's looking a little more tired than the sprightly Lynn Brown that we saw an hour ago, but how interesting it is. Peter in Greenside. Good evening, Bruce. What would happen to the JSE should South Africa be downgraded to sub-investment status? I would anticipate, Peter in Greenside, that we would see pressure come to bear on banks and industrials. I would anticipate a weakening of the currency. And as so much of the money that the larger companies on the JSE make is made out of South Africa, I think it would be positive for the index, but it would cause a devaluation of your money. So if you weren't exposed to markets in that sort of scenario, in index funds or into the Rand Head shares directly, whether that be British American Tobacco, Anheuser-Busch, InBev, Naspers of the world, then you would see the value of your money deteriorate very, very much. That would be my assumption on this one, Peter in Greenside. But it is the topic of discussion, a much more detailed and far better informed, because it comes from a financial advisor, discussion that I'm having with Warren Ingram tomorrow night at 7:15. So this time tomorrow, Warren Ingram will be moving into studio to answer that precise question. And it is about how you as an investor behave at critical inflection points, at times of crisis. Business Unusual now brought to you by DigiCape, the go-to authorized Apple reseller and your local Apple expert. Start the conversation at digicape.co.za.
The Money Show. Business Unusual.
Tell us about the latest, Colin Cullis, our Money Show Business Unusual correspondent, the latest in extraordinary robotics.
Atlas did a backflip.
What?
He didn't shrug. He did a backflip.
Yes. Atlas Shrugged, of course, is the Ayn Rand book, the seminal sort of textbook for right-wingers who just loved Ayn Rand's take on economics. But Atlas is, I'm taking it, not an Ayn Rand derivation.
No, this is a bipedal robot, 20 years in the making, and the product of a loud shirt loving professor from MIT called Mike Robart. He's the guy from Boston Dynamics, and this evening we're sort of profiling the really incredible work that has been coming out of that company, and where potentially it points all of us with the rise of the robots, or as I'm thinking now, they're running and jumping and backflipping into the 21st century, and they hopefully will take us along with them. His kind of uniqueness for me is that as engineers, they tend to have a certain wonder about the world. But even in his talks, he stands up on the stage and he just puts his arm and he says, "Aren't we amazing?" And he's making a great point, because when a human being stands upright and doesn't fall over and is capable of knowing where it is, that is amazing. And trying to replicate that into a robot has taken a very long time and a lot of money. You know, typically when we build robots, they just have the ability to be an arm and it can pick things up or move them, or it can see something and stuff like that. But his plan is to build these general purpose robots. They need to be able to do what we can do. And he kicked it off back in 1990. He was working at MIT. And the U.S.'s, and we've mentioned these crowd before, let me get this name right, the U.S. Defense Research Advanced Group, DARPA, is pretty much what they're known as. And they give money for all sorts of interesting projects that usually have a military sort of thing to them. And this robot he was tasked with building, or offered to build, would be sort of a support robot. It was like a big cow-looking thing, and it would be able to trot along with soldiers carrying 150 kilograms and be able to stick with them for sort of 24 hours. And it's amazing. This thing really can. It can walk through bushes and up hills and
it's
downstairs.
You would think war movies of the future will be called War Cow instead of War Horse, because effectively what it's doing is replacing the live animal on the battlefield, as was used 100 years ago, say in World War I.
Yeah, and the fact that modern soldiers carry so much more equipment, so they need something to go along with them. They called it big dog. I don't think they thought that cow would ever count as sort of a macho thing out in the field. But as it goes, it runs. It's got an engine to manage all the hydraulics, and it's super sophisticated. But you can imagine if you're stealthily trying to work your way through the bush and you hear this, people are going to spot you coming a long way away. So they wind up shelving it in 2015. So a good many years working on it. But as they sort of evolved, it got smaller. So big dog became little dog. Little dog spawned cheetah. Cheetah has got a recumbent back, so it can run really, really fast. It can jump. And it's quite scary when you see a machine moving around at that sort of speed. Then they made one called Spot, and Spot Mini is its current sort of commercial thing. So Spot Mini looks like a small dog, and it's got a little robot arm that goes on the back of it, which for some people who watch Alien a lot, it looks like that mouth that came out of the front of Alien. So kind of a scary looking thing. But the plan with this Spot Mini is, because it's so small, it can actually be used around the home, or as they're suggesting, you know, a lot of work going for deliveries now. You'll have a delivery truck drive out near the part of the building where you live or on the street where you are, and then out jumps Spot Mini with a package. He's holding the package, and he'll wander over and put it down carefully at your front door wherever it needs to go, unlike some of those videos you see of people just tossing them over the wall.
But also, sort of, I mean, I think it came from Boston Dynamics, a video of a robot trying to put a box down on a table, and the entire scene collapses into chaos, and eventually the robot falls over backwards in capitulation. That's often the image that we have of robotics, clumsy robotics, but this is changing that dynamic, and alarmingly quickly too.
It has been kind of quick. So 2015, I think, is probably a bit of a watershed where all of those different systems come together. But perhaps maybe just a little more on that Atlas video. So it was released on Friday. And most of their videos have got a good couple of million views. They're all on YouTube. But this one only released on Friday, and it's already past the 10 million mark. Because in it, you see this bipedal robot called Atlas, third generation of him, by the way, or it. I'm not quite sure what gender they get given. He hops up on a box. He then hops over to another box. He then jumps 180 degrees. And you're thinking, okay, that's a lot better. Because, yes, usually you see these things take a couple of steps, hit something, fall over. And they do that a lot. They still do that. And then he executes this backflip. And to Boston Dynamics' credit, it's a 55-second video. And he does the backflip at about 45 seconds in. And then they show their credits. And then they show you the outtakes. And it's basically him landing on his head and falling badly and doing all the other stuff. So, hey, they get it. This is not – we haven't reached the top of Olympus here just yet. But they're also very creative in trying out different means for getting robots to move. So he's fascinated by animal and human movement. So they've also built this thing called – it's called Rise, and it can climb walls and really works like a gecko. It's got those same little six legs as opposed to – gecko's got four legs. It's got six legs and those little grippers that geckos have got and that tail that sort of can hold it. And it can climb up a tree, no problem. It's kind of slow, but it'll get there. And then the sand flea, which is remarkable. It's this little wheeled robot thing, probably as big as your hand, four big fat wheels, and it zooms around. And then you see the thing stop, and it stops in front of a building. I've posted all these videos online for people just to watch and realize how far we have come. And it rises up onto its back legs, and then like a flea, it launches itself. Good 3.5 meters landing on the roof. You think, okay, that's great. How are you going to get down? And it just rides right off the end of it. It's kind of very robust, and so it'll survive that. And again, there they're looking for sort of search and rescue kind of things, surveillance, and just really getting robots to places that otherwise it's been very hard for them to move
it's
around in the past.
All very Bond, James Bond.
Yes, this is exactly the kind of stuff you imagine Q rolling out. I wouldn't be surprised if the next one, Q doesn't show some Boston Dynamics kind of thing. Because the craziest one for me is one called Handle. So it's kind of got two legs, but they're two wheels at the end of those legs. And this thing can really zoom about on those wheels and jump. And then it's got arms that are sort of stick out the back of it. So it sort of leans over backwards almost to pick up loads. And can pick up like 50, 60 kilograms. And then it goes whirring about with these things. So you can imagine Jeff Bezos is saying, that's what I need at my Amazon super headquarters and have all these machines flying around. And that's possibly, you know, the kind of scary bit with this is that they are going to be capable of working alongside us, if not saying, hey, buddy, I can work longer hours with a lot less trouble. And that's really what the focus of tonight is. So I'm applauding the engineers. And then I'm saying, I don't know if it's the philosophers we need to ask, but they have to step up and start saying, do these robots get rights? Do we treat them in a certain way? The one you saw with the packages, for example, to demonstrate how robust they are, they knocked the package out of the robot's hand. And I got to say, as I watched that, I thought, the guy was being a bully, that you shouldn't treat a robot like that. And then you remind yourself, it's a machine. But I don't know, if we start treating machines like machines, do we start treating other people like machines because they look like us? You know, do they get rights? Do you have to give them the vote? Because strictly speaking, if you're going to trust them to drive your car and look after your safety, why can't they possibly make more rational decisions than even we can with this? So I leave that there as a very big question up in the air for how we resolve this. But they do have one very endearing thing that might be actually humanity's best thing. We know we're getting older, and we know we want to maintain our independence as we get older, but we will need that support. And so this spot robot dog thing or some human-looking thing may be just the thing that is there to be vigilant, near us to assist us, you know, intervene when it needs to, but super private and will just let us be what we want to be. This could be the future of elderly care.
It could most certainly, and certainly elderly care would improve dramatically, I believe, wholeheartedly. When you look at Atlas and you look at that video of succeeding in the execution of the backflip, that humanoid, that human-like movement, the hands going above the head and doing double fist pumps, that freaked me out completely. Because you know it is so such a human reaction. Yes, you can program it, but it is that moment where you go, look at him. Not
the parent, of any six-year-old will know exactly the sensation, because what you're watching is a child learning.
No. If a six-year-old does that, you ban them from the trampoline for a month. There we go. Colin Cullis with Business Unusual this evening, talking Atlas, the Terminator of the future, potentially the massive leaps forward and backward rolls of technology.
The Money Show.
The Big Five.
The Big Five brought to you by Worksman's Attorneys, your legal specialist for success for the last century, keeping you close for 100 years. Visit worksmans.com. Some drenching downpours, long overdue drenching downpours in Cape Town last night. Not enough to move the needle in terms of dam levels, but very welcome rain indeed. Enver Dumini joins us now, Cape Town Tourism Chief Executive. The Big Five things you're doing to help not only the tourism industry through the drought, but I suppose the city of Cape Town, the whole of the Western Cape, which is going to be deluged, if not in rain, by tourists over the holiday season. Enver, are you ready and braced?
Good evening, Bruce. Yes, we are. I mean, I think for us, there's a few things in play. Because, like you said, we are expecting volumes of people to be coming to Cape Town. And the economic impact that it has and the jobs that it creates is important for us. But again, the rain today is a good indication of saying, hopefully this is a sign of things changing.
Hopefully it is. Now, how are you getting the message to your members to get the message then to the tourists to say, please, we don't mind if you smell bad, but please don't use all our water?
Well, we do a few things. In engaging with the industry, because we are actually an industry body, we made sure that already in 2009, we created a responsible tourism charter focusing on a few things, but including energy and water. And it's through those programs and initiatives, we started saying, well, how do we make sure we can conserve water? And then, of course, inform the visitors. And a lot of the industry has actually rallied behind this, from removing bath plugs to changing laundry systems, removing alien vegetation that would feed into the water, aquifers, etc. And I think for us, that is kind of an indication of why the industry understands the plight of the city, but also saying, we need to also play our part as part of the industry. So from messaging to members, we've been doing that over the last 12 months already, before it kind of got into level 5 water restrictions. Yeah.
I mean, does anybody who goes to a hotel and sees, we're in a drought-prone area, please, keep your towels, and if you need to have them washed, put them in the bathtub. I mean, it's a fairly passive way of delivering the message that we see in hotels around the world. It's not unique to South Africa. Are we ramping up the message to show just how deadly serious Cape Town's water situation is?
I think we are, and there's always that misunderstanding about the international tourists. I think they are a lot more sensitive to the needs, and they are adapting behaviors accordingly. I think the major challenge is for the local citizens and changing our behavior, because I think we've become too accustomed to water and kind of letting taps run continuously. But I think to your point is, what we have done is made sure that we amplify and continue to increase our messaging now before people get into destination, whether we go to global trade shows, whether we do it on all our digital platforms. But also, more importantly, is finding innovative ways. For example, Hotel Verdi, close to the airport, they actually have a system called Vedino. So it's a local currency they created. And if you change your behavior, they actually give you Vedinos that you can use within the hotel. So again, I think there's lots of innovative ideas within the tourism space, in order to address this.
I mean, things like SAA, I've been to Cape Town a couple of times on SAA, and you don't hear the pilots when you land saying, guys, please don't wash. There doesn't seem to be, is everybody buying into this messaging thing? Because I would think that that would be a very effective first point of call, the pilot when you land, not just saying, please drive carefully.
Absolutely. And we have engaged with AXA, who have at least gotten quite a few of the airlines, I think actually most of them, to start announcing it. And we have been engaging and asking them to engage with SAA, to your point. And again, we can't force people, but we're hoping that somewhere along the line, every single airline will continue to announce it.
No, you mean, again, there's some lovely schemes ongoing at the moment. Cape Talk is in partnership with ShopRite in terms of water-saving devices at schools, and Cape Town is really rallying behind that, and big donations coming through in order to help schools minimize their consumption. Sunlum's come out with the two-minute shower song campaign, which, again, 2 minutes in the shower is actually quite a long time, but it's raising awareness and making everybody, and I think there's even a billboard here in Joburg on William Nicol and Sandton Drive, which saying, if you're going down to Cape Town, here's a two-minute shower song for you. There's lots of awareness going on.
No, absolutely. And I think the partnership specifically with corporate allows us to extend the message beyond kind of the local government messages and even our own. So I think the two-minute shower song is an innovative way for us to your point, get the message across. But to the other extent as well, it allows visitors to actually get to a taste of South African culture and music. So I think there's also that cross-pollination that happens. But for us, I mean, even while I'm here in Joburg, I mean, I'm even still conducting two-minute showers. So you guys yourself have some water restrictions going on here. So I think it's going to affect everyone in time, and everyone needs to start changing their behaviors, whether in a drought-stricken area or not.
Yeah, I mean, we're water slack, and it is raising awareness completely. The responsible tourism charter is a big one. Reaching visitors is a big one. And now we see today that Patricia de Lille, increasingly as the mayor of Cape Town, has been pushed to the forefront of campaigns on water saving. You just can't get the message through strongly enough, I don't think.
Well, I think that it's going to take time, and this is more around behavioral changes than anything else. But I also think, you know, this is a good opportunity for social cohesion. Everyone in townships actually experience and live in this way every single day with a single tap amongst multiple families. So I think for us, it's a good also opportunity to say, well, how can we learn from them? Maybe there's some innovative ideas there. But also, how can we potentially fast-track some of the initiatives, you know, to address kind of and kind of almost feel their pain to some extent? So I think, yes, I mean, from a mayor's perspective, she has been communicating. But I think everybody has to play its role, whether it's a family member with visiting friends and relatives coming over December. Everyone has to play a role.
Where have you been staying in Joburg while you've been here?
Well, I'm actually at the Hilton.
So, at the Hilton. Have they got water? Because all of Sandton's been without water. It's like Joburg is training Cape Town what to do when there's no water. It's been quite a use. You must have felt perfectly at home, actually, Enver.
I am, because the thing is, the minute I came in, there was water restriction notifications. I was told what time the water was going to come on. So I felt right at home. And I was almost tempted to take a three-minute shower, but realized, hey, I'm still doing two-minute showers. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
Be responsible, Enver. Set the example. Cape Town Tourism Chief Executive. Tamara in Fourways, you've just come back from Cape Town. Did you get the message loud and clear?
No, Bruce. Shockingly enough, I didn't. Actually, I was just going to phone you to see this a few days ago to be just like, I really don't understand what you're talking about. We went to Cape Town for a long weekend with the family. We booked an Airbnb, but we stayed in a hotel. The only signage that we saw the whole time we were there was one of those boards on the highway that says this is a water, water is, you know, scarce or whatever in Cape Town. Please use water wisely. We could have used the dishwasher. We could have used the washing machine. We could have taken a five-hour shower. There was nothing put in place. Nothing at the Cape Town, at the V&A waterfront. I saw no signs that said, please use the water responsibly. Where are those? Where are those posters? Where are those signs? Where are they?
Tamara, thank you. You're angry about this. I would like to suggest to Bongani Maseko, thank you, Tamara, for expressing your anger. And Enver Dumini was listening to that. He's heard your anger. I would like Bongani Maseko at the Airports Company South Africa to donate some billboard space at international arrivals in Cape Town and at domestic arrivals in Cape Town. Tihiso, Anthony, Lefifi. Can you give Bongani Maseko a call and say to him, Bongani, if you've got any spare inventory going and you've got lots of billboard space all over that airport in Cape Town, how about donating some of that to the city of Cape Town as a good corporate citizen and getting some pictures of empty dams put on those billboards? That would be a nice gesture, Bongani. That's a suggestion. It's not a demand. It's a request. A polite one, as politely as we can put it. If you don't respond by tomorrow, we'll get demanding. But you must have spare inventory, surely, at the airport. And just donate some space for a couple of months, especially over this tourist season. You'll be doing some good, Bongani. Okay, so $50 to the first person. No, don't have $50. My wallet is empty. Bongo Musa Makatini is the new chair of the SABC. I was going to say, name the new chair of the SABC. I'd be surprised if anybody could, because it's only been a month since he has taken over this role. He doesn't have a particularly high public profile. He's worked in corporate for many, many years. Worked as a consultant. You shouldn't hold that against him too much. As a consultant at Accenture, he's worked for all the Sin companies and still works in Sin. SAB Miller, he worked there for about 8 years, six years, and most recently at British American Tobacco. You grew up in KZN as a rural kid, grew up cutting sugar cane and labouring from a young age.
That's correct.
Was it? What was the dream as a kid?
My biggest dream was to transform my family from poverty and get them to a point where they could have a decent living, and also to turn around the situation, because I had seen my father struggling, my grandfather struggling, and I said, I need to do things differently from the way in which they did things. So education became my passion and my goal.
But the goal was not realized, not initially anyway, because you're in matric, your dad dies, and suddenly you're responsible for the family.
No, my father didn't die. My father is still alive.
I beg your pardon. Okay.
But basically what was happening...
But something bad happened in that matric year. Things fell apart a bit.
Because I grew up in an environment where there was political violence between the ANC and the IFP.
Where was
North
this?
Coast, that is Mpangeni, North Coast of KwaZulu-Natal. So I had to take responsibility and basically support my mother and my siblings with their education. So I started funding their education while I was still at school. So that gave me quite a huge responsibility on my shoulders while pursuing my own dreams of going to school. But I had to also to help my siblings with their education.
What were you doing to make money?
So the first job that I did, I work as a farm worker in the sugarcane farm. So basically, I'll do that on weekends and when during school holidays. And then after that, I got a job with Jetstars at the time as a sales assistant.
Were you good at that?
I was good at it.
Did you get commissions?
A lot of bonuses. Okay. I mean, if I were to call it like that. And then I also did hard work, like building churches, because I was... very active at my church. So that's how I used to get money. And then at the later stage, I opened a little tuck shop in my village, where also, because I had to find ways and means to get money to support my family while funding my own education.
So you had to be resourceful. But the dream was to be a doctor. And that dream,
my dream was to be a doctor, yes. Yeah. No, that dream was not realized. Because when I was in Standard 9, I realized that because I did not have enough time to study and practice, mathematics and science requires a lot of practice. But I didn't have time because I had to work and study. So I had to quit the science stream and go to general, because I was sure that I could get distinction and get admitted in a university without having to do away with my work. So that dream I had to...
But you chose teaching as a quick fix to get into paid work and to get yourself a decent salary, because, again, that family pressure...
That's correct.
...was a case of like, well, got to do something. What's the quickest way to get a proper job? Ah, teaching.
Teaching, yes.
Did you teach?
Actually, I never really taught. When I finished my degree, my honours, I was appointed a part-time lecturer. So I did lecture, but not in a school where I was meant to go.
But the University of Zululand.
University of Zululand, that's where I was a part-time lecturer.
So how did you get into corporate then? Because you suddenly get quite on a rapid, fast track. You get into Accenture and you get to SAB, which is, as I said, Kevin Hedewick, the former chief executive of Famous Brands, once told me, the best MBA in the world. Yes. And then to British American Tobacco.
How I got into Accenture, actually, as part of my job, I had two jobs with the university. I was a part-time lecturer, but I also was a student development officer. As a student development officer, I was responsible for attracting companies to come recruit my students. So then I negotiated with Accenture to come recruit my student, and it took long to convince Accenture to come recruit, because they used to go to VETS, UCT, and then I said, Neo, there's talent here, come. Finally, they came. So after interviewing my student, a guy, it was Tembi Kuzwayo, I think she's one of the HR executives at Standard Bank, and Jeremy Piercus. Then at the end of the day, they said, Bongo Musa, actually, we're more interested in you.
They hired you.
I said, no. Guys, I invited you to come recruit my student, not me. Then they said, no, we like your passion, we like your leadership, your drive, and the things you've done as a student leader. We'd want to give you an opportunity to work for Accenture. That's how I ended up with Accenture.
Now, so you are non-executive chair of the SABC. Do you keep your day job at British American Tobacco?
Yes, yes.
And what is that job?
So I'm basically the director of legal and external affairs for BAT Southern Africa. So that is.
So you're big on stamping out illegal cigarettes?
Yes, I'm big.
Things like that. I mean,
that's my passion.
That's the main focus.
Yes.
That could get you into trouble, and you know, if we believe the stories around SARS, and I mean, yeah, that's a conflict of interest working in the public sector, isn't it? And stamping out corruption in the illicit cigarette trade.
I am of the view that South Africans hate corruption, and I believe that there are South Africans who are passionate about fighting corruption. Because at the end of the day, if we don't tackle the issue of illicit as a problem, this whole economy will become problematic. I mean, the estimate is that about 10% of our economy is illicit, which is over 200 billion. That's a lot of money, and we can't fold our arms and do nothing about it.
Unfortunately, you're going into a really toxic environment. I don't know if the environment is still toxic. The environment at the SABC has been gradually increasingly toxic over the last 10 to 15 years. So, and we saw the mad reign of Claudie Motsoeneng and Ben Ngubane, who let him get away with it, and Ubaba, who loved Claudie so much, who let him get away with apps. He could do almost anything. People lived in fear at the SABC. Is that what you found now that you've arrived there? That's only been a month, but what do you find there?
It is correct. My assessment, the situation there is quite dire. Systems are not really working correctly. People are not adhering to the standards and the policies that are there. And this is what I said during my interview, that the SABC problems have got nothing to do much with broadcasting per se, but it's general lapse of consequences management and people doing what they need to do and held accountable for the decisions that they make. So it is quite in a dust state. You look at the financials, you look at people that are being are on suspension, you look at the cases that are being investigated. It is quite a lot that needs to be fixed. But as a board, we're quite confident that we can turn it around.
Why did you accept the job?
It's always been my dream that at the end of the day, as South Africans, we can't keep on pointing fingers and complaining. You know, if the ship is sinking and we allow that water to come in, ultimately we're going to all drown. So at some point, we've got to have South Africans who roll up their sleeves and go and do something about the situation of our country. That was basically one of the things I wanted to do. I've been working now supporting my family for more than 15 years, and I wanted an opportunity to do something for South Africa that has got nothing much to do with me benefiting financially, but using my skills, experience, and expertise to contribute in a meaningful way.
Why are you the right person to turn around the sinking ship that is the SABC?
One of the things that when you look at what makes somebody qualify for a particular task, you look at their education. I mean, I've been fortunate with all the difficulties that I went through as a child. I had an opportunity to go to universities, University of Zululand, University of Johannesburg, and Harvard. From an education perspective, I've got the right exposure. But secondly, when you look at the companies and the work that I've done in the private sector, I've worked in the consulting space. There you're dealing with systems, you're dealing with processes, you learn to drive efficiencies, you learn to develop models, which makes companies profitable and more efficient. That's the experience I got from a consulting environment.
But in all your years of consulting, have you ever come across such a travesty as the SABC?
No, I wouldn't. I haven't. But what consulting does for you, you get exposure to various industries, which gives you exposure and experience, which then when put together with the experience I got from SAB, where I was director of corporate affairs, dealing with regulations, stakeholder engagement, driving projects, and those kind of activities. When you look at that combination, it then gives me what is required around the SABC. But of course, I also work with a team of capable South Africans. I'm not the one-man show. So if you look at my board, you've got people from different walks of life with different experiences, and together we will then be able to do what is required.
There are even people with media experience on your board.
That's
which is kind of crazy, because for a long time we've had nobody with electricity experience on the Eskom board, nobody with any broadcasting experience on the SABC board, nobody with any aviation experience on the SAA board. Perhaps we are in for a turnaround. Bongomusa Makatini is the new chair of the SABC. We get on to the more tricky questions in just a moment.
The Money Show, Shapeshifters.
Our shapeshifter is the new chair of the SABC, Bongo Musa Makatini. He is in studio with us this evening. What about the allegations that you are there as a political appointee? The suggestion, not even an allegation, it's a suggestion. You served on the Bongi Ngema Zuma Foundation as the chair of that foundation, and that led to the assertions that somehow you're connected to the Zuma family, that you're buddies, and you're there as a plant. In South Africa today, nobody trusts appointment anymore. What's your response to that?
My response, I was very passionate about helping society around issues of diabetes, because part of the major problem with diabetes is that because people don't screen and they don't test, so at the end of the day, they end up not knowing, you know, and being able to manage the condition. So my father is diabetic, for an example.
Okay.
So when I was invited, because a colleague of mine that I used to work with from Accenture requested me to go and assist the foundation put a strategy together, which was based on my experience in Accenture. So put a strategy together and help the foundation to focus on the things that can make them effective and help them succeed in achieving their vision, which is about seeing a South Africa where nobody dies because of lack of awareness. So that's the reason why I got involved. Basically exaggerating that passion for fighting diabetes with my relationship with the president, I find it to be a little bit exaggerated, more especially because when you look at what that foundation does and what it's been achieved, it's been able to achieve, really it's got nothing to do with politics. It's pure public health and American wanting to contribute.
Do you have a relationship with the president?
Other than meeting him whenever we had sort of fundraising events, because he was very keen to know how we're doing as a foundation and supporting our patron, who's his wife, I'm not friends with the president.
And did he appoint you? Did he make a phone call to say, this is your call-up, this is your country duty, please will you do it? Or did it happen some other way?
No, he didn't call me up. In fact, even when I got a call that I will be the chairperson, I didn't get the call from the president. I got the call from the people from his office, not him.
If I scroll through your cell phone, would his number be in it?
No, it won't be.
Okay, just check. No, he's handing it over. He's handing it over. What do you make of the fact that the moment that you're appointed as the SABC chair, people start sniffing around for dirt? What does that tell you?
Well, the problem we have is that we've lost trust. I mean, you know, off air we spoke about this, that people tend to scrutinize everything, which is okay. But also at the same time, once they've been given explanation, they should allow you and trust what you tell them. Because the truth of the matter is, there's been great appointments that were done by President Zuma. If you look at Thuli Madonsela, he's one of the success stories of this country.
He didn't make that mistake again, did he? No.
If you look at Mogoeng, the judge president, is an appointment by the president. And there's a whole lot of other South Africans who are appointed by the very same men who've gone and done well. And my plea and my request really is to allow me and my board space to do our work and judge us on what we achieve and the results of our work.
It's been a month already, one board resignation. Rachel Kalidas, who resigned in an absolute froth over the appointment of a new chief executive of the SABC. She says the candidate for the SABC is inappropriate, concerns of fraud and corruption hanging over his head, as well as strong conflicts of interest. Why did she quit?
To be honest, I think she was running away from taking responsibility and accountability for what she had done wrong.
What did she do wrong?
As a board, we had a meeting with all 11 non-executive boards engaging with the candidates that we were scrutinizing, interviewing and engaging for the positions that are available. In preparation, we had an hour prep where I've basically said, colleagues, let's sort of agree on what are the areas that we're going to be focusing on. That was the first thing. Then the second thing is everybody was given an opportunity to engage these individuals because we had them in front of us. Anything that may have been of concern, we were given opportunities to do that. What was strange with Rachel, she decided to keep quiet. After the interviews, the candidate leaves. Okay, we have a deliberation for over 3 hours as a board. Of course, there were people who had certain things, and then as a board, we had to debate issues, and I think that's healthy. Any board that is not able to deliberate and engage robustly, for me, is not an effective board. We had a robust discussion. Then at the end of the day, then she starts raising, the first thing says, I want my dissent to be recorded because I'm not happy with this candidate.
And the candidate, the DA has said, is Alan Mukoki, who is the former chief executive of the Land Bank. Is that a fact?
I'm not going to confirm any names. I have got to respect these candidates because they are employed somewhere.
All right.
So until the process is finalized, I don't think it's fair for me.
When will that process be finalized?
We're having a meeting as a board again on Friday. just to review, because what had happened with the group CEO, we set up a team to go and really not dig up, but do a thorough research around this candidate, because we don't want to make a mistake.
No.
We don't want to also exclude people based on newspaper headlines. There's been a lot of instances where people get labeled wrongly or falsely accused. So you can't say this person is not suitable based on a newspaper article. You've got to do thorough research. And that's what we've been busy with.
How are you going to restore trust, public trust, in the public broadcaster?
Firstly, is to have the right executives with the right competences, the right experience, and the right profile at the helm of the SABC. That's the first thing.
Ethics?
Ethics, values, all of those things are required to help us restore the SABC. But also we've got to defend the independence of the SABC. We must be seen to be adhering to the Constitution and the Broadcasting Act. The third thing is we must be seen to be taking decisions that are sound, that are objective, and that are in the best interest of South Africans.
Have you had a single phone call from a politician in the last month directing you in any particular way, or so making any sort of inference or suggestion as to the way in which you manage the board of the SABC?
I haven't had. I haven't had any politician calling me to do a thing, one or two.
And no intermediaries either? No secret notes?
No.
Because the people move in mysterious ways. When you look at your TV screen and you look at the parliamentary channel and you look at the scrutiny under which former executives, former board members of Eskom are coming under the most extraordinary scrutiny we've probably seen in our democracy. And does that sort of make you go cold a little bit and go, therefore, but by the grace of God, go I?
What gives me comfort is that the board that I run has got people with the right competence. Sometimes people go into boards without having not much to offer, but also not being experienced in the field. Of course, we don't all have to be experts in broadcasting, but if you look at the team that I have and that I'm part of, it's competent individuals who've got very good reputation, who are credible individuals, who will do anything to defend their own credibility. And that, for me, gives me comfort. And they're all passionate about the SABC and the country at large.
And when you look at those hearings, do you look at them and go, we better ensure integrity on this board because we could be next if we don't get this right?
That's correct. It's actually a good lesson. I mean, observing what is happening, it just helps you to focus and to know that if you do wrong and if you don't do what South Africans would be proud of, you will be exposed.
When will we know who the new chief executive of the SABC is?
It's hard to tell for now because the appointing a CEO for an organization of SABC size, you've got to do thorough work.
Within a month?
We're not going to rush it. It can't be done within a month.
Okay.
No, it can't be done within a month.
Big job ahead for Bonga Musa Makatini, the new chair of the SABC.